This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Before Jane Goodall, before Diane Fossey, there was George B. Schaller, the pioneering wildlife biologist whose groundbreaking field research transformed our understanding of gorillas, tigers, lions, wolves, and countless other species, helping shape modern conservation around the world. But Schaller's own story is every bit as remarkable. In her new book, Homesick for a World Unknown, my guest and acclaimed author, Miriam Horn, tells the story tracing George B. Schaller's extraordinary journey as one of the most influential conservationists of the last century. We'll explore a life defined by curiosity, courage, and a profound belief that understanding the natural world is the first step towards saving it. Miriam Horn, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure and an honor to have you. First of all, let's start with, why isn't, like, Jane Goodall's name a household name? Why isn't George B. Schaller's or George Schaller's name household?
Well, it's a combination of both his temperament. George is a man who has never been as at home among his own species as he has among these other species. Was an extremely difficult interview. I spent many, many hours over many years with him, but he was the kind of person that if you ask him to talk about himself, he would answer in one sentence and stop. He was never one who enjoyed the limelight. He also had a strategic reason for staying under the radar because he spent much of his life in politically complicated places like Pakistan and Tibet. And Brazil and Argentina when the junta was there, and so it served him often to be under the radar. And then there was really a third reason, which is that he recognizes he left an enormous legacy in terms of the survival of species and national parks that he helped create all around the world. But the legacy he counts most important are the young scientists that he inspired and who often apprenticed themselves to him in all of the 32 countries in which he worked. And so he wanted the light shone on them. He didn't want it shone on him. He did train Jane Goodall in her earliest days with the chimps and was always grateful to her that she did have this wonderful public charismatic personality and could kind of fill that role that he just was too awkward a human being to really want or serve.
Oh, we have all types, and it is wonderful that we've had Jane Goodall's been here in Park City, or she was before she passed away, shortly before she passed away. And it is wonderful and infectious to have that. But now you get to tell the story of George Schaller. And along with his story, which is quite remarkable, is the story about how you came to have him say, okay, you can write my biography, your persistence, your tenacity. Tell us about it.
Well, so the idea was presented to me. I have been in love with wildlife since I was a little girl. I kind of dreamed of being a wildlife biologist, and I got sort of close. I worked for the U.S. Forest Service in Colorado, and I worked for Environmental Defense Fund, often on wildlife habitat issues. But I knew it was kind of now or never after my last book came out. So I asked actor Jane Alexander, who is also a lifelong wildlife advocate. We ended up in Austin together. And I asked her what she thought I should do. I said, I want to give the rest of my life to wildlife. What should I do? And she said, well, you need to write the biography of George Schaller. When she looks back on it, she has no idea why it popped into her mind, mm-hmm. but she made the introduction. George is ever the gentleman, and so corresponded with me by email, but said, no, thank you. I appreciate your interest. And it turned out he had said that to dozens of suitors before me. So I kind of persisted. I said, well, could I send you a copy of my last book? And he agreed, and my last book begins in Montana with ranchers who have learned how to live with grizzlies and wolves. And so he saw that I understood these are complex stories, but no thank you. And I said, well, could I just come visit you, just to pay homage, really, to the legacy you've left? And he allowed me to come up and visit. And I spent a few days up there knowing that, as you know, as a journalist, that the second day feels different than the first. And So I visited a couple days and I sort of laid out for him and his wife, Kay, you know, if you did say yes, of course, you'd have to let me read all your family letters and open your photo albums. And so they hosted me but kept saying no, thank you. And then I was getting, on the last visit, I said, okay, well, I'm leaving town tomorrow morning. I'll just drop by to say goodbye. And when I walked in on that final morning, Kay handed me a stack of those old aerograms, that tissue thin paper, and said, these might interest you. And I looked at them and they were these absolutely marvelous letters that she had been writing to her mother in Anchorage, Alaska, from the Congo in the 1950s and central India in the middle of a tiger park with their toddlers in the 60s and the Serengeti in the late 60s. And I knew that no had turned to yes. And I was telling this story at an event in New York City with Joe Walston, who leads Global Conservation now for Wildlife Conservation Society, the job George Schaller once had. And I said, you know, first I thought it was kind of my journalist instincts. And then I realized, oh, no, I habituated George like he habituated the gorillas. I just stuck around long enough that he got used to me. And he said, oh, no, you did a much smarter thing. You got to the silverback through the smarter female. So it was really Kay in the end, I think, who gave me the nod. And he trusted her instincts about humans because she was way more at home with humans than he was.
Yeah, he was more at home with gorillas.
Yes.
Kay Morgan, who was, they met in college in Alaska, right? And she went with him on many of his expeditions, adventures. She took notes. She was part of the whole operation, and he wanted her to also be recognized in this book. And so I suppose you recognize her from the get-go by talking about her influence.
Yeah, whenever I would walk into George's house, and Kay died a few years ago, so particularly after we lost Kay, the first thing he would say to me was, I hope Kay is as much of this book as I am, because there really would never have been George Schaller without Kay. She did accompany him. They lived together in this tiny cabin in the middle of the Congo jungle. She was this petite little blonde that the media went wild over and called her Fay Wray always, because here she was in the land of King Kong. And you know, she managed in these cabins. This cabin was at 10,000 feet, no plumbing or electricity. She still would manage to bake George like little peach pies and just really create a warm home for him. And then as they moved on to tigers in India and lions in the Serengeti, she raised their little boys amidst these big carnivorous cats. And then as the boys got older, the family separated more and more because they wanted the boys to be kind of in stable schooling. And so George would go roam in Central Asia and the Himalaya and the Karakoram for months at a time while Kay held down the fort. So she kind of kept their whole home and family life together. And she edited all his books quite rigorously. And he wrote 22 books. He won the National Book Award for one of them. He was a brilliant writer, but in part because he had a brilliant editor in Kay.
Wow. If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm having a conversation here in the studio at KPCW with acclaimed author Miriam Horn. She's talking about her new book, Homesick for a World Unknown. It's about the life of wildlife biologist George Schaller. So I think when I heard about your book and I started looking into George Schaller, I first found out about his work with giant pandas and a PBS documentary that remains one of the most watched PBS documentaries about this man. At what point did his work with pandas tie into all of the other work that he did?
Well, so he spent the first decade and a half of his expeditions in these national parks in Africa and South Asia. And his renown by the end of those studies was so enormous. He was really, that you know, anyone who was concerned about wildlife knew of him by then. He then worked in Pakistan and Nepal in much of the 70s, and he made a trip that many people will know of with Peter Matheson, the trip that ended up resulting in Matheson's book, The Snow Leopard. That's actually all I knew of George when I came to this project, was that he was GS in that book. And then there had been talk, so China was still locked, totally closed to the world. It was just coming out of the Cultural Revolution in the 70s. But there had been talk of a panda study. And basically, they would only do the panda study if the Western scientist that came was George Schaller. That was, and
wow.
So they were able to, it was World Wildlife Fund, actually, who borrowed George from Wildlife Conservation Society. And in 1980, he went and he spent the next 5 years living in a tent in these high-altitude, icy bamboo jungles that pandas live in. It was some of the most arduous. He lived in really hard places. He lived, you know, in the most extreme landscapes on Earth. But this was hard not only because it's very cold, but he also had to live in very close proximity with his Chinese colleagues who were still in the culture of the Cultural Revolution, where people informing on one another and very afraid of the Communist Party officials and having to navigate politics that were so Byzantine that, you know, finding your way through them was incredible. And pandas are also about the hardest animal on Earth to see, which you wouldn't think with that bright black and white coloring. But the bamboo is a very thick screen, and they don't move all day because they have these mismatched metabolisms where they can't actually, the only food they eat is bamboo, and they can't actually digest bamboo. So it's like a fluke, a bad turn in evolution. So they have to eat, they only can digest like 17% of what they eat. So they basically have to sit around night and day and eat. They can't spend any energy, and they have to shovel in bamboo nonstop. They can't hibernate. They can't sleep overnight. So they don't move. So he once walked every single day through this iced bamboo that was like, you know, getting lashed by frozen sticks for 8 months without seeing a panda. So the fact that he spent 5 years at this incredibly difficult task, Kay was with him much of the time. He fought a very difficult fight against what turned out to be the biggest threat to the pandas, which was this rescue mission that the world got on, where some people will remember the Pennies for Pandas campaign in the early 80s, where there was a myth sort of spread globally that the pandas were starving to death because of a bamboo die-off. And George kept saying, the pandas are fine. It is very, very local. If there's any problem, pandas have dealt with this for millennia. They just walk somewhere else. But they all started to be taken into captivity. Mm. There were only 1,000 pandas left on Earth, and half of them ended up in captivity and never came out again. The real motive was that Western zoos discovered they were the greatest draw of animal and would pay $1 million a pair a year to rent a pair of pandas. So George fought this just difficult fight, which he finally prevailed, and he endured these difficult circumstances of study and living, winning the trust of the Chinese to such a degree that following that, they gave him 40 years of access to Tibet. They gave him access to Tibet that no other Westerner has ever had. He made 65 trips to Tibet, studied these animals that live in the, you know, in a landscape so harsh, not even nomadic herders go there. So the pandas were both incredibly important in and of themselves. I mean, and it was kind of a profound stage for him because he was really, the pandas were more difficult for him to read than cats had been, or certainly gorillas. He felt like, you know, he could completely read what was going on. Pandas were more opaque to him. So they kind of cast him into some of the deepest philosophical reflections he ever engaged in. But they also opened the door to 40 years in Tibet, which is
unprecedented. Yeah.
And will never happen again. So,
right. So, as you're talking about this perseverance and this fortitude and the ability of George Schaller to find himself in the harshest of environments to do his work, it ties back to in my mind, to his very interesting childhood. And was there some connection? Did he have some need to make right or, you know, something like that, this interesting childhood that he was brought up in, and you can tell the story of.
Yeah. Well, so George's mother, Bettina, was a kind of a debutante from the Midwest. She grew up in a fancy family. She was schooled in Swiss boarding schools, was multilingual and gorgeous. And in 1932, she married the German consul to Chicago, George Sr. They sailed for Berlin just in time for George Jr. to be born and for Hitler to come to power. And so his father was told if he wanted to remain in the diplomatic corps, he needed to join the Nazi party. So he did. So George grew up in wartime Europe with an American mother and a Nazi father, loathed everywhere he went, for they were transferred repeatedly. They were in Katowice, Poland. They were in Copenhagen. They were in Prague. They were in Berlin. And everywhere he went, he was alienated from everybody else, either because of his American mother or because of his German father. So he grew up in tremendous isolation. He was often in countries where he didn't speak the language. He didn't understand the culture, which would prepare him well for going into animal cultures where he didn't understand the language or the culture. He learned to fend for himself a lot. As the war got heated up, his parents started shipping him off to boarding schools, trying to get him away from the front. It didn't work, but it did cause him to have to learn from a very young age how to fend for himself. And he had to live with a lot of physical privation. They were quite hungry for much of the war. By the end of the war, they were in a displaced persons camp after the war ended, and he was scavenging in dumpsters to get bits of egg for his little brother. And so he learned to really live with tremendous physical hardship, with these separations from his family, in these totally unfamiliar cultures. So he could drop not only into animal cultures, but also human cultures where he didn't understand them, and navigate as he did with the Chinese politics. I don't think it is a coincidence that having grown up in the darkest chapter of the 20th century, where these othered beings were persecuted, you know, where it was decided that they were reviled enough, that they were other enough and dangerous or enough to be, that for a genocide to be committed. I don't think it's a coincidence that he devoted his life to trying to protect the most persecuted beings on earth, the most reviled and feared and loathed beings on earth.
Speaking of feared and loathed, when he went into the Congo to study gorillas, there was a lot of the prevailing belief by quote unquote scientific experts at that time was that the gorillas were violent and you couldn't go in without a shotgun, and there would be this really difficult time to do any studying whatsoever. But George Schaller didn't believe that. Why didn't he believe that? Did he just have a second sense and an intuition?
I think he did. Partly he had a rebellion against authority, which I think was also one of the legacies of his childhood. He saw what, you know, authority had produced, including the false science that drove the genocide. And so he grew up with a deep skepticism toward authority. And so, yes, he was told that, you know, the whole world, when talk came up of George, this young man, he was 26 years old, going to live among the gorillas, all the experts around the world said this is a suicide mission, starting with Louis Leakey, who was in Nairobi, and Sally Zuckerman at the London Zoological Society. I mean, these were the grand men of science. They all said this is a suicide mission. He's got to go with a huge retinue, those, you know, with the pith helmets and the guns, and he's got to carry a gun, maybe armor, maybe a disguise. And this went on for a couple of years, this debate, and most of them said he's not going to survive it at all. And he just refused it all. He knew that if he had a gun, he certainly knew he had to go alone or the animals would be terrified. He knew he had to always stay in sight, so, because he knew that, you know, like us, you're more afraid of the unseen. And he didn't want to carry a gun. He had carried a gun when he was a student in Alaska. He'd shot a lot of animals, but he understood that if he carried a gun, it would change his affect in a way the gorillas would sense. And so he went alone without a gun. And I mean, Kay was there in the cabin, which was pretty, she was pretty brave herself to be in that cabin by herself, sometimes for days at a stretch, when, because he would go, the gorillas got so used to him, they let him sleep at the foot of the trees that they nested in. So she would be home alone in that little cabin. But it, I think it was a sixth sense. I heard from the greatest wildlife biologists in the world, legends in their own right, that there was the rest of them, and then there was George, that animals behaved with him in a way they behaved with no one else. Ulas Karanth, who's India's great tiger biologist, told me about a tigress who he would go and watch every day. She would take a bath in a lake, and then she would walk out the back side of the lake so she didn't have to come near Ulas. Well, the one time he brought George there, George was on a return visit. The one and only time in months and months of watching her, she came out of the lake and walked right in front of George as if she was paying tribute to him. There was something, and a snow leopard, he took the first pictures of snow leopards in the wild because the snow leopard not only let him get close to her, she let him sleep near her for a week, and she brought her cub out of hiding and let him experience her cub at close range. And it's like, it just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen to other scientists, but there was something in him that they sensed.
It's just a fascinating story of George Schaller. And your book is titled Homesick for a World Unknown. I just love that title. I'm wondering what it means to you. As the only person to have written this biography, it's what an honor.
Well, it was. I mean, I was really aware because, you know, part of the process of getting here was George kept a field journal every single day, thank God, because he was such a taciturn talker. But he kept a, you know, in real time, basically, he kept a record of the 70 years he spent in the field. And so I got to read, I was the first person ever to read those journals, 20,000 pages worth. And when he's in Tibet, so I had learned that his whole life, he was dreaming of Tibet. He was in all these other incredibly beautiful places. But as a little boy, one of the places he'd gone to escape kind of the trauma of being in a war zone was he was reading the adventures of these explorers of the early 1900s. Including Sven Hedden, who was the last person to walk across Tibet in 1900. So he would dreamed and dreamed and dreamed of Tibet and wondered, dreamed of it so hard that he wondered if you could be homesick for a world unknown. It's actually his phrase that I found in his writings. He knew it was home, even though he'd never been there. The book jacket is a picture of him looking into the Arctic, in the Alaskan Arctic. He's on the Shinjek expedition, which created the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And again, he's looking into this place that he hasn't been, but he knows is his home, and he's homesick for it already. And then it kind of began to have other meanings. He's homesick for the world that was in many ways already lost by the time he got there. He came to realize many of these landscapes were already emptied out of most of life. So he was homesick for that world when there were, you know, tens of thousands of tigers roaming from Turkey to Indonesia. He was homesick for a kind of childhood. He would go to these villages that were very rooted and these very strong community and family ties, and he would be homesick for the childhood he never got to have. Somebody else suggested that he was kind of homesick for this world of animals that he could enter to a degree, but there was always a point at which he couldn't go past. And so he almost became a snow leopard, he almost became a lion. But so it has taken on more and more echoes as time has gone on.
And I'm wondering, kind of to wrap this up, unfortunately we're almost out of time, but as he changed, I'm curious about how you changed over the 10 years, the decade that you spent talking to George Schaller. He let you in like he didn't let in any other journalist ever. You know, we crave stories of adventure. You know, your work was steeped in conservation and wildlife and then the environment. How did it change you as a person?
Well, I think it showed me, for one thing, that I would never have made it as a wildlife biologist, because the degree of patience and fortitude that was required, the 999 hours of nothing that you had to endure to get the 1 hour of, you know, really incredible, and the rigor of his observations, that how carefully he would count, you know, every time this lion licked that lion and when who licked who back. And, you know, he counted everything with such rigor. So I kind of made peace with the life that I didn't I didn't get to ever have or had to live vicariously through him. I also, though, did often find myself channeling him when, I mean, it was, I came close to being defeated many times. It was making my way through this treasure trove of primary sources, but still an ocean. I was swimming in an ocean. And a lot of times, I mean, like in when he was in northern Pakistan, just even figuring out where he was physically would have me in tears, because he was in, you know, the towns would be four huts at 18,000 feet that maybe had a name, and it, but if they did, it was in Urdu, or it was in the it was in the local language, and so what I was reading was transliterated, and so it would appear five different ways, and is it the same village, a different village, and so there were things where I just really thought, I'm never going to get to the other side of this, and whenever that would happen, I would find myself channeling George and his own persistence, his own acute attention that was like nobody else's attention. You know, he saw everything, he heard everything, and he could read tracks like nobody else. And so I apprenticed myself to him in a way, but in this indirect way, to learn some of those, to take on some of those same habits to the degree I could, to get myself through this process and to just appreciate the world we're in even more than I already did.
It shows the importance, especially for those who aren't extroverts, who don't have a lot of verbosity, that they do journal, that they keep these diaries. You couldn't have written this book without his diaries.
Oh, not in a million years. I mean, they were unbelievable. I mean, he's an absolutely beautiful writer, and often he could lift things right out of his journals into his books. But I mean, it was in real time. He would have, 10:17. I mean, there was one incident that really showed me the degree of attention and patience he brought to the world, where he was watching pikas in Tibet. The Chinese were poisoning pikas like we poisoned all the prairie dogs. So he was trying to study pikas, and he was watching a polecat hunting pikas, and it had snapped a few, and they finally went underground into their burrows. So at 10:17... He's always like precise on the time. At 10:17 in his journal, he records that the pikas have gone underground. Well, the next entry in the journal is like 2:35 in the afternoon, and the pikas finally poke their nose out. He's been sitting there for 4 hours watching those burrows to see when the pikas poke their heads out. And so, yeah, it was, he would let slip often what he was feeling. He sometimes would write on the backside of the journal page when it was no longer the official journal. It was where if he was in a struggle with Kay, or he was missing her, or he was feeling, he quoted some Pashtun poem about daggers in your eyes. And, there were times where this life, the separation sometimes brought tensions with them. And so he would let a lot of that stuff spill into the journals too. So I had this, it was like a camera was set up next to him through these 70 years, and I just got to watch it unfold. So, but no, without them, plus this family, though, they lived through many wars. I mean, he was in the Congo when the Belgians left, and he was the one and only person there defending the guerrillas. But, they lived through the Second World War. But somehow they kept every letter they ever wrote. So I had 100 years of family correspondence, and these incredible pictures he took, and the incredible drawings he made, and the flowers and feathers he pressed into the journals. And the telegrams that people were, the New York Zoological Society was sending him in the Congo saying, get out. It's too dangerous there. Get out. I had all of that. So, I mean, it was a really amazing honor to...
And we should mention, George is, 93 now? And how has he received the book? And I'm curious, I mean, his wife Kay is gone, but how his children have received it?
Well, it's been really fun. It was nerve-wracking, I will say, when I sent him the manuscript. We had agreed that he should read it in manuscript to help catch any errors that I might have made, though I had many scientists read it because I was terrified. He was so precise. I did not want to make any mistakes, but he kept me waiting for like 10 days before he responded. I was on pins and needles. When he finally responded, it was kind of a torturous day because he was sending me these email messages that were a little obscure, but finally I reached him by phone and he said, I've just been trying to reach you to tell you what a marvelous job you did, that you showed me things about myself I didn't know. So he did catch two mistakes. I had misspelled the word forward in my footnotes, and I had twice neglected to, when I was using a scientific name, to capitalize the genus. So when that's all, the only mistakes he found, I was dancing in the streets. I felt very proud of myself. His sons have also really loved it, and they were so helpful. One of the really charming things George did is, if he was missing a birthday, which he missed most of them, he would, or any special event, he would do a cartoon that he would send to them. And so Mark, his younger son, was sharing these just wonderful, charming cartoons that he would make. They were, where the family were the stars of the cartoon, and they were really brilliant. And so, and the boy, they gave, let me read their journals from the expeditions they did with him. So, but they've been really wonderful. And probably the most moving talk I've given about the book was at the assisted living facility George is in Hanover, New Hampshire, that his sons asked if I would present to the community in that facility. And they were riveted. They had no idea
who this man was
in their midst. So that was a very, very moving experience. And so that's, thank God, I was so nervous, but it's been a wonderful to have their response. I wish Kay had gotten to read it.
Well, she knew you were working on it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And she was an enormous help, not only because she was the one that said yes, but also because she was much more voluble than George. So when I'd be at their house interviewing him and she'd watch him clam up, she would sometimes step in and either nudge him back open again or fill in some of the details that she was there to witness. And she was just funny and charming and gracious, and she was really one of a kind too.
Well, what an honor for you to have spent a decade of your life this way, really meaningful. It's wonderful to have that kind of meaningful work, and an honor to have you stop by the studios of KPCW today.
Thank you. An honor to be here. So thank you for making the time.
Absolutely. Miriam Horn, author whose work has focused on conservation, wildlife, and the environment, traces the life of George B. Schaller in her new book, Homesick for a World Unknown.